When the city lights go up, the poet's endless beat begins. He trades on his words to build a sound clientele and establish favorable conditions. Although charm and strategy can be important factors in his career, they are not necessary. But they do attract the attention of patrons, since they can be immense sources of status. With his dress, attitude and parlance, the poet indicates his trade. Sometimes, in defiance of the rules, he appeals directly to the reader. He charges 30 to 15,000 for a poem ranging from a few lines to a series of pages. The rate for a book varies between 5,000 and 50,000. Lower grade poets average 5 to 8 readers a year. They make 4,000 to 8,000, but others earn extraordinary sums. 60 readers a week is not unknown during festival seasons. A daily tax has been worked out. In the English-speaking world, 20,000 to 30,000 a week, payable annually. Poets are subject to critical supervision. Editors conduct raids, interrogations, and anyone found infringing the law is sent for publishability tests. Controls have been attempted on their movements. Regulations forbid loitering with intent at certain hours and in neighborhoods such as Soho or the Champs-Élysées. Even though a sober poet is a liability, undesirable because he doesn't stir up a fuss. People imagine poets are perpetually inspired. This is not true. They do try to avoid blocks by chemical or other means, but when blocks are confirmed, suicide is rare. The poet must always be at the reader's disposal. He must accept anyone who pays. Time off is allowed after each profitability check. The poet usually takes a trip, often to see his family in the country. Afterwards, he goes to the cinema or the seaside. Well, hello again. Thanks for having me here tonight. That was a poem called Live the Life. And it's essentially a found poem which I adapted from a section from a screenplay of the film Vis-a-vis, the Jean-Luc Godard film. It's a question and answer session in the film detailing life, the life of a prostitute in 1960s Paris. I use found portraits, I use found texts a lot in my work, and there'll be examples, multiple examples tonight from what I'm going to read. Another thing I use is the dramatic monologue. I prefer to call it persona poem. I use the voice of particular historical persons or imagined persons. Basically what I'm saying is that I'm not really a confessional poet. Sometimes I am. Pip. It came inside me like the pip of a tangerine or grapefruit. Tiny, but inconvenient enough to matter. I couldn't just think it away. It gained a foothold and began to take a life of its own, sucking away at my energy and urges. It muddled up my desires, tastes, and personal smell. It ballooned and bloated me as if I'd eaten a bad meal. I watched with horror expecting it to claw its way out of my innards any day. But it just grew. Soon, there wasn't much room for my lover in our bed. Three really became a crowd. I had to do something. I kicked him out. I ingested pills, alcohol, smack. The blasted thing would not die. I took to hammering through to it with forks and chopsticks, but it just rolled up like a hedgehog, all slimy, and I heard it vowing revenge. I went to a hairy-armed doctor who said he would remove it seamlessly at the right price. I didn't trust him. No seams would have wiped out this memory. No scars would simply say I had never carried this cherub, my munchkin, inside me. I kept feeding it with guts and blood until it was strong enough to go it alone, until it squeezed out of my bottom parts. Only, it wasn't as easy as all that. Dubious words. I use here the voice of Shura Weddle, who was kind of a footnote in the whole Sylvia Plath, Ted Hughes mythology. Insofar as her mother, Asya Weddle, was Ted Hughes' mistress, etc., etc., etc. And I just thought I'd use her voice for this poem. I have a little byline here. Shura Weddle died with her mother in 1969, aged 4. What might I have grown up to be, mummy? A tap dancer? A marketeer? A maitre d'? A poetess, perhaps, like your legendary rival? Or like her daughter, the half-sister I almost had? Animals and dolls, wooden toys and petticoats spring from my stunted memory, jumbled like the artifacts and accents you picked up with aplomb and carried in your luggage. A man we began to call Daddy would vanish and return sometimes with gifts and with food and siblings that turned us briefly into a family. Then again vanish, denounce and banish us from the royal records of his feet. Who decreed we had to hang on to that man's caprices? This was post-war England, with its peculiar certainties and mistrust of foreignness and all things remotely German. Yet, she'd been much more the Hausfrau you could ever be. That was her one aspect you refused to copy. You settled into her effects and ended up possessed by her. You composed your own epitaph. A lover of unreason and an exile, you felt rejected by a man you deified. This could crush women hardened in post-feminist times. Add your society's mistrust of you, born of your whims and indiscretions, I know, and the labels people stuck on you. The other woman, she-devil, faithful enchantress. You, not he, were the death of her. And your final solution seems almost rational. Why must we be a footnote to someone else's story, now spawning books attempting to explain us and our death? Who are these people claiming to know us, mommy? Who gives them the right to invent for us a voice? Pictures on glossy paper and dubious words is all they have of us. Thank you. This poem is about fashion, world politics, Michelle and Carla. Don't bother issuing denials, ladies. These photos leave room for doubts. For a start, as you gaze into each other's eyes, the intense tête-à-têtes, the resting of heads on the other's shoulder, the relaxed familiarity, the gentle holding of hands, though it's not clear whose is the upper hand. What's quite clear is that your love is warm. None of that dog collar and gimp costume stuff of the Bush and Blair era. Theirs was a hardcore affair, best kept under floorboards in grubby basements, alongside snuff movies, pederasty and coprophilia. The porn the two of you produce is soft, of a kind accessible by anyone over 12. According to these mags, you've begun to borrow from each other's wardrobes, your styles intermingling, as if we're in the grip of another nouvelle vague. And which of you controls the hair and the best escorts you? Is it a joint venture? An equilateral arrangement? Embedded reportage of your satin smooth romance would be infinitely preferable to copying photographs from Gaza and Chechnya or the nuclear militarization of North Korea. Maybe it's just old perverts like me who think like this. Thank you, in any case, for stalking our fantasies for years to come. I'm participating in a writing project, an online writing project, in which all invited writers are free to choose a given date, given day, and sit down with a blank piece of paper and write something out of nothing. Nothing that was pre-planned, nothing was pre-thought. And submit this piece for publication within 48 hours. The project's not online yet, but it's currently underway. Some very interesting pieces already in it. I've given myself an extra constraint while doing this, in that I perform the act of writing in strange and unusual and a little bit sometimes difficult circumstances. For example, my first piece I'm going to read here, I wrote in the middle of a very rowdy pub while a football match was happening, and I was right at the front and I was writing. Everyone was shouting, throwing stuff at the screen, etc. And the third part, the third bit I wrote while driving. There is somewhere between the journal and the notes towards a poem and a finished poem, but I think that's was quite interesting about them. They're certainly not polished. Right, first one, the bunker. We leave our bags and anoraks at the door. Inside, we take our vests off and bear our prejudices without having to listen. We turn the volume up to 100, stoke the passions. We are a partisan lot, like it or not it. We circulate coupons and red tops, booze and tasteless jokes. Gays and blacks are not welcome here. Foreigners, only if they're real working men and have proved it for at least 10 years. We operate like wise guys out of Goodfellas, on favors and obligations. We remember our dead with darts tournaments. We tie our stools in their names. We can sell whatever we want, smoke if we fancy it, and to hell with Europe. We are standing our ground in the face of all these invasions, taking refuge in our multi-screen bunker, until word's out that dinner's on the table. or till the cows come home. Whichever the latest. Funeral. Lugubrious church bells lure me from my garret, a ghoul on the scent of fresh death. Like the best of deaths, I'm greeted by a shower of sun rays, the twittering of birds, wildflowers. The car park is no fuller than normal. The synod of old men huddles by the gates. Women turn up with a spring in their steps. I push the heavy wooden doors. A sore thumb with my pen, beachware, and crocs. Just mass, not a funeral. I can't say I'm disappointed. White light, stained glass, the dull echo of murmured verse, a consenting slowing of life's mechanics. The business of faith observed like any other. The busybodies, the curious, the diehards, the casual, the solemn, the official, circling the core event soon about to start. On the road. This is tricky, dangerous, almost certainly illegal on the potholed roads of North Fingal. Eternal roadworks. While a stretch is being fixed, another is cut up by nothing more than rain. Machinery, construction altering the shore. How long will that brand new house stand before erosion collapses into the sea? The spot where we crashed that day. Helicopter, tailbacks, ambulance, baby seat on the asphalt. That unidentified man off the beaten lanes, through a relic of a town, neat as a 1950s experiment, into deep country, golf course, GAA, harvesters and tractors, slow crop transport, more potholes and cow dung, horse riding on the roads, killer bends, the town with both a north and a south beach, infested with commuters, and a Polish shop on every street corner. Old town folk too. A motor yard. I've got to read a longer poem now. It's made up of four parts. Nothing more to be said about it. Safe as houses. One. Language. Language tells all. It's as close to a god as we'll ever get. Investigate it. Believe it. It lives in the earth and in our bones. Its roots are immortality. Two, ship of fools, the luck of the Irish. They say our homes, shacks not many years before, went up in price more spectacularly than anywhere else in the world. That we built them anywhere, as if there was no tomorrow. That we traded them like cards. We allowed the encroachment of funds that had no legs, and rezoned our practices to benefit those who could get their hands on the bulk of it. And to hell with the vulnerable. It's always been our patriotic duty to shield and venerate our lovable roads. We are first rate at turning a blind eye and operating on mutual obligations. We thrive on secrecy, winks and nods, impenetrable language. Our skills were honed over centuries of colonial rule. Yes, we could carry on owing our former masters everything. We are being dubbed the Wild West of Europe, and as haphazard as Kabul. Yet, for a moment, there was a chance to set high standards of fairness and embark on pioneering campaigns to meet them. But our ship is full of fools, and we blew it. Now they say we're sinking faster than anywhere else in the world, being washed away by a torrent of funds that never existed. Our homes are worth as much as the shacks our parents and grandparents toiled in. They say our luck has run out, but our only chance is charity. And that charity begins at home. 3. The architecture of chance. Engineer the falling into your hands of an arbitrary envelope. Watch out for cameras and men in uniform. Sneak it home, open and examine it. Argue its insignificance to yourself. Look at it intermittently, letting dust settle and cobwebs form on it, until it appears illuminated in your sleep. Probe the sender's name and address. Investigate their workplace and activity patterns. Unearth pictures of them. Compose a message and decide on a means of conveyance. Send. Don't bank on a response. Repeat the process, plotting coordinates towards construction as you go along. Four. Collected emails. 24 June 2008. I've only now received your email. I hadn't checked that account in ages. Yes, I'm still in Ireland. This is my work address. Please contact me again if you wish. I wonder if I can still help you, and how. 27 June 2008. Of course I will meet you. This all sounds very interesting. Let's arrange something maybe in 2 weeks' time. My parents are visiting at the moment. 5 August 2008. Sounds great. I will do my best to be there. It's in my diary now. 12 August 2008. Looking forward to seeing you. 9 October 2008. Just wondering how you are and if you're back in the country. I was in Poland for a week, but now I'm back in the office. 26 November 2008. I'm afraid I won't be able to come this Thursday. A good friend of mine is leaving to work in Bahrain. The situation is getting complicated everywhere, even in my company, and more people are forced to join offices in Dubai, Bahrain, and Qatar. I hope it won't happen to me, because I really like Ireland. 3 March 2009. I have enjoyed the Christmas break, and now I'm looking forward to my break in April. Still doing well in my job, luckily. A lot of people lost their jobs in recent months. 19 March 2009. Today, we learned our department is closing, and we will be made redundant on the 16th of April, getting closer every day. I guess this adds another chapter to the whole architecture story. Everything has come to a standstill in Ireland. I'm hoping to stay for another while though. There is still a lot I want to see. The cliffs of Moher, Giant's Causeway, Lakes of Killarney. There was never enough time for this. Then hunting for a job again. 23 March 2009. Unfortunately, I won't be able to come. I'm finishing jobs in the office, and as part of that, I am flying to Cork. But I'm up for anything after the 16th of April. 18 May 2009. Caring was wonderful. Also a really nice sunny weekend. Was it the last one this summer? Looks like it. Yes, I am still doing a few days here and there. It looks like it's going to be very difficult to find a job. Not to mention that with a foreign name, it's twice as hard. I have been looking for nearly a month now. My boyfriend is still in the same company, but not for long, I'd say. We'll look for a new destination soon. When do you think this recession is going to end? I'm glad it doesn't affect poetry. 14 July 2009. We have moved apartments recently. I'm still trying to get internet connection there, and I'm also getting a laptop this week. Everything is up in the air. We're in Ireland till Christmas. I have already started to look for work in the UK, and I have interviews coming up. It's really bad for jobs over here, so no point waiting any longer. 16 October 2009. I have moved to Scotland. I live in Glasgow now and work for North Lanarkshire Council in Motherwell. At work at the moment, actually. 19 December 2009. Glasgow is fine. I'm getting used to it. However, I can't deny I miss Dublin. Read a couple of poems from the chapbook, Around the Clock, a few copies here, for anyone who is dying to get rid of 5 euro first. two poems from it, delighted that Warren Press printed the second one, first run was sold out, first poem was written after a visit that I made a few years ago to Cezanne's studio in Aix-en-Provence. The studio at Le Lau. A bedless house, a lime tree cloaking it in ordinariness. Two ground floor rooms looking out to a yard fizzing with green filtered air. Visitors milling around nervously, sucking spirit in, exhaling it in money. Sunlight streams into the studio of the stairs, his smocks and hat hanging there, the easel, bowls of fruit, and a statuette of Cupid, all scarcely touched in 100 years. And from the enormous window at the back, there is no view of Mont Saint-Victoire. Who is it that darts among tree trunks or marks out thinking paths, suddenly upon clearings, encountering sculptures and geometrical arrangements of nature, but kids brought along for the ride, who end up investigating every corner, bypassing a vague reverence? The Impressionists. Round them up, the Impressionists, even those straddling the margins of their place and time, idealists prone to self-harm, hermits opting to stay unwashed for weeks, students of the bodies of chocolate prepubescent girls, and lock them in a house loaded with cameras and microphones. Force them to speak our language. Offer them a budget, scarcely adequate for food or tools, and present them with tasks. To construct a sunrise, say, or to stay underwater for an hour. Insert moles, temptresses, divide them into bedrooms of three. Command the sun to scream overhead daily. Scrutinize them as they disintegrate into bedlam or rally around leaders. Then, make them stand up and nominate each other for execution. Naturally, the decision on who survives the vote rests solely with us. Repeat the process occasionally until only one remains to be declared the greatest impressionist of all time, before he too is brought before the guillotine. A couple more, if I have time. Okay. Another poem based on visual arts, I suppose. Three parts. It's called Triptych. It's after the video installation by the American artist Bill Viola, called Nantes Triptych. Anyway, this is my piece. Triptych. One. Is that my son's head I see beneath his mother's pubes? His mother, who's become limbs, dilations, buckets of yellow-red juice, distant animal screams. Later, she says, giving birth feels like dying backwards. Being born must be like falling forward into a huge pool, the seed of our deaths already rooting inside. The blackness of pain, its otherworldliness, the little surrenders to come, all things of natural order. Two. Gurgling, muffled heartbeat in the ears, sunlight barely passing the water's skin. Grey, hairless mammals grappling, killing for chunks of stray flesh. Goggle-eyed, heavy. Until they find strength to float or rise to the surface and gulp some air again, momentarily. But there's no more strength. Three. Watch your loved ones expiring. Bury into an inner vault the film of their decay for private screens. Their deep, cumbersome breathing, the simultaneous holding on and the releasing, inch by inch, of their matured death? Or is it a folding back into themselves, like a many-petaled flower? And before the last poem, just once again, thank you for having me here. I'm enjoying it. And this is called It's True, You Buy Into Nothing. See, if you hadn't paused for that long moment to stare at the blonde in the magazine and her obscene curves, if you hadn't desired that woolen hoodie and followed the scent of cannabis into the store, or veered from your stated path into a ghetto of ethnic food, entered a Victorian drawing room teeming with Girl Scouts under a heavy air of euphoria, listened drowsily to a sunshine chant, imagined clouds into speech bubbles, stopped to eat cake and drink absinthe, writhed in corridors bathed in yellow light, or looked out into a bright courtyard and a glowing grassy patch through plexiglass windows that diffused everything with fairyland luminosity despite everything. See, if you hadn't fooled around like that, then you would have been on time to catch me in my film, talking about myself and my achievements, my philosophies. You would have got to join in with the throngs of my groupies, all mascarad and dressed to kill, clamoring all over each other for the best seats, gagging for introductions to those of us with influence. See, you too might have met someone good for you, or learned something.